You're listening to BBC Radio London. I'm Dotson Adebayo. You're listening to Dotson on Sunday. So we're talking about Remembrance Sunday. We're also talking about Armistice Day tomorrow. And we're talking to Mars Roy, who's here in the studio with me. Mars Roy is with me in the studio talking about a lot of the other things that he's been through, because he was one of those people who was here in the BBC. Well, not at the BBC, but he's been here with us at in the UK for some 60 years plus or so, and talking about all sorts of things that he went through once upon a time as well. Mars Roy, Stanley Roy Archer, more commonly known as Mars Roy, is a community activist, a visionary, a founder of Jeffrey Town Farmers Association. Didn't know that. Unofficial mayor of Jeffrey Town in St. Mary's in Jamaica. St. Mary's probably the most beautiful parish in Jamaica. Well, one of the most beautiful parishes in Jamaica. I don't want to get involved in that. Sorry?
I'm laughing.
Well, it's true.
You're covering yourself, aren't you?
Of course I have to. Samira's Yvonne Archer, who's with us as well. She's an author, therapeutic life story worker, broadcaster, but she's also the person behind Mars Roy's autobiography. So do you mind me looking at that autobiography? Let me just remind people. It's a very immaculate, again, photograph of Mars Roy in the army with his trusted rifle beside him, looking very, very, every inch the sort of perfect soldier. Absolutely fabulous. Life According to Mars Roy, it's called. Yvonne Archer and Stanley Roy Archer. Is it still available? Can people still buy this?
Absolutely. Go to our website.
Okay. We'll get it from your website. And what's the website?
www.ourpieceofhistory.
Okay.
And peace is spelt as in peace and love.
Right, yeah.
All
it's not
one word,
right.
Our piece of history.
I didn't think it was spelled like rice and peas. Don't get me wrong. No, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't have thought that in any case. So we're talking about life in the military, and you can't get any better than Mars Roy's biography, because it does tell you what it was like being in the military, doing the national service in the 50s. I'm fascinated by the fact that he was one of the few black soldiers around at that time. He's also told us about how the governor of Jamaica at the time came to visit his regiment and stopped to talk to him. Well, you're not surprised, are you? I wouldn't have been surprised about that at all. Interestingly enough, though, Mars Roy is wearing two poppies today, a black one and a red one. Mars Roy, tell us why you're wearing two poppies.
Well, the first thing, you have to show that you're even-handed, you see. It's no point you do something on one hand heavier than the other one. You have to be, especially in these cases, you have to be very even-handed to even get people to trust you. So, you know, I think that is one of the things I do take care of, to be even-handed, whether you're dealing with color producer, you have been called out for splitting a difference between two people and so on. Even when you find the person a bit wrong, you have to take him one side and coax them down, talk them down. Like when a plane is coming down, you know, in danger up there, you have to know to talk the pilot down till him land. Then when he land, you say, what a naughty boy he was, or something.
Ah, Master, you've got a sense of humour. But we all know what the red poppy means and what it symbolises. What about the black one? What does that mean to you? What does that mean?
There, what was it? By the boxer name of Clay.
Yes.
You remember somebody asked him some question.
Cassius Clay?
Yes.
Muhammad Ali?
Yeah, Muhammad.
Floats like a butterfly and stings like a bee.
Yes, right. And he says black and white, and he explained two. And he said, no, you have it in black and white, so you can't go any further, because the person have the answer in black and white.
Ah.
I don't know if you remember that part of it.
I don't remember that part of it as well. I don't remember that part of it as well. But it's good, it's good. And we'll talk more about that as well. There's a lot to talk about. In fact, since you came, and I must say, can everybody give Mars Roy a round of applause for being dressed so elegantly. Even though there are two other gentlemen in uniform in the house, Let me just say, Master Roy, you know, nobody dresses like you old timers anymore. You know, you can tell straight away you're a military man just from the way you dress.
Well, I've been in England, and I have 1 foot in England and 1 in Jamaica.
Where's your Jamaican foot? Where is it? I'm only kidding. You've got a sense of humour.
I spend quite a lot of time there doing different activities, as you rightly say, getting things together because things was out of order, nothing happening for the young people, and so on. So you have to go there with a coarse hand, even-handed, but very coarse hand to tell them where a person go wrong or they could do better. And it would take me all night to tell you, or you'd have to go yourself and look what happened in Jefferson. Jefferson Farmers Association is now on the world map. We do everything there. In fact, one person called me. I hope I'm not going offline.
No, you are going offline, but you go.
Just last week, and was in tears, one of the person there.
Yeah.
You know, flour.
Yeah, the price of flour.
Wheat. They're cutting that out and gone back to cassava.
Oh.
And you know what cassava is, don't you?
Of course, yeah.
Cassava flour to make, we make breadfruit flour to make bread.
Yeah.
There now, because the breadfruit you support, things point when I tell you to take my own life to explain some of these things to you.
We might have to have a different program on that one, Master. Yvonne.
Can I just add something? I think, personally, that the reason why my dad is so confident about making major changes in community and being a community activist is because of his experience in the military. I do believe that it's made him a confident person. It's made him well organized, trustworthy. People trust him because he's been a member of the military.
But what about that post-traumatic stress syndrome that you mentioned?
Yeah.
What about that? How does that display itself? You mentioned, like, when you're learning to drive a car, he tells you never to drive over something that's covered.
That's right.
Does it display itself in any other ways? Post-traumatic.
I'll give you an example where he. Apart from that, one of the stories I remember him telling several times was how once in the area where we lived, he heard this big, massive explosion. And I think that took him back to when he was in Cyprus during the conflict. And he talked about that sound quite a lot. And he said the bus drove over. I mean, it's kind of horrific, but the bus drove over someone's head and it went bang, like an explosion during the conflict. And it's things like that. I think he must have been hearing sounds and identifying them with other sounds he'd heard during that time. It's just when you think back that you pick up on these things. I'm sure the Major's probably introduced you.
Well, yeah, indeed. We've got Major Jared Flurry with us of the United States Army, also an assistant professor of English at West Point as well. Good evening and welcome to the programme, by the way.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be on it.
Great uniform, by the way. You know, well, why do Americans always have sharper uniforms than the British soldiers? Why is that? Yeah, I know, that's another. I'm coming on to that one. Dr. Jack Beulah is here in the studio as well. Why is that? Do you guys take pride in the fashion of the uniform? You look a lot slicker than our equivalents, if you don't mind me saying so.
Thank you. Yes, and I think I do look a little bit flashier than Jack as well. Perhaps we try to make up for a class with flash, come to think of it.
No, it's important, isn't it? We've been talking with Master Roy about this, how military people present themselves even out of uniform or out of combat uniform. Why is that such a biggie? Why is that such a big deal?
As the gentleman was saying, I think a nation places a great deal of trust in their armed forces, and they expect demeanor, confidence, and respectability in them. They don't necessarily expect in the private citizen. That's why it hurts us so very much when we hear about military men and women perhaps doing things that fail expectations. We expect more. The stakes are higher. And when one is in an environment that always expects respectability, always expects service to a greater cause, responsibility to others, then I think one is acculturated into that process of thinking not of oneself, but of a of being a part of, you know, what John Steinbeck would say, a bigger soul, a greater soul. Right, a man ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a great big one.
You can always quote Steinbeck on this program. I have no problems about that. Why not? I actually passed by Cannery Row once. You know, I was driving up in Northern California. There was a sign saying Cannery Wharf. I was like, whoa, this is Steinbeck country. So anytime you want to come on and quote Steinbeck, feel free. But I must ask you a couple of things. Obviously, what you're saying is partly that the military is a life and death profession. You know, you can't joke around in the military, can you? It's a life and death profession. How conscious is a soldier of that?
Conscious daily. The business of militaries are is the application of violence. And there's no short-circuiting that. The military operates in a greater capacity, has a greater context of providing sort of a touchstone to a nation. In the case of West Point, for example, it serves as a nexus for transmitting American values of duty, honor, country, the school's motto, a sense of respectability, and American and the greatest of American virtues. We host cadets from all over the world. And it's fun to put on flashy uniforms and go on parade and speak about these things. At the end of the day, though, we're all highly conscious that we serve the nation's interests. And the military's role in that is the application of violence. And we may be sometimes called to apply violence that that we're uncomfortable with.
Well, given that, is it inevitable that a soldier leaves the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome, as Yvonne has said, that she feels she identifies it in her father, even though his military service was 65 years ago, and she sees signs of it now. Is that an inevitable part of the profession?
No, I don't think so, nor would I suggest that Jim would suggest that. I definitely respond to firecrackers in a different way than I did
really?
Before.
Really? Fireworks, bangers, rockets going up and everything?
I wouldn't say that I'm triggered by the 4th of July Independence Day celebrations, that is. But an unexpected round of firecrackers will sometimes get my attention. For example, visceral ways.
Well, examples, you know, we've been having fireworks night here, bonfire night, you know, but we're in that week of bonfire night. Are you a bit jumpy when you hear those firecrackers go?
No, not particularly. But again, my experience has been a much a grander and gentler experience of combat. I'm a pilot. I generally fly away very quickly from gunfire.
As you should, as I would as well, by the way. And thank you. And let's carry on this conversation. Feel free to join in the wider conversation. Dr. Jack Beulah, why are you dressed in American military uniform? American military uniform. What have you done? You know, people like you used to get shot once upon a time. Have you sided, well, not with the enemy, but with the other side?
Okay, so my uniform is ceremonial. It's almost a take on the Michael Jackson uniform homage. And today, of course, being Remembrance Sunday, I thought I'd don my thread, which I think
looks
does
good.
Compete
Don't
with,
get me wrong.
Correct Major Flurry. I think I'm the sharpest, best brother in the house.
Apart from Master Roy. Don't forget Master Roy's in the
of
house.
Course, well, of course.
Of course, you had an event at
Windrush
Square.
Windrush Square today was absolutely wonderful.
What was that? What was the event?
It was to commemorate Remembrance Sunday, of course, and the African Caribbean Memorial, as you know, is the only memorial still that celebrates and represents the African and Caribbean contribution to both world wars. So this is our third year now.
I never know why it's important to commemorate the African Caribbean contribution to the world wars. Well, why is it important to divide and rule in that way?
No, it's not really. It's
okay,
not really.
It's not?
What it is it's remembering the forgotten. So until the memorial was there, African and Caribbean people didn't feel there was a monument that they could provide their hurt commemorate their ancestors, because unfortunately up until perhaps the commemoration of the 100th anniversary of World War One, African and Caribbean contributions were very minimal. So we'd go down to the cenotaph, and of course there was not many regiments from Africa and the Caribbean represented. So I'm pleased to say that has changed in recent years. But we also have our own monument, like other groups do as well. And it's a good thing. So it's not really divide and rule.
Yeah, it's, it wasn't, and if I might just get a little bit political, it wasn't, if I might use this phrase, our war, was it? It was a European war, this. Yeah,
it was,
and
indeed.
You call it a world war, but essentially, you know,
but it was... The fact that 2 million of us, well, I will say 2 million of us lost our lives, but let's just say the established narrative right now is 2 million of us participated in that war, and it was a war that took place on African soil, as we know, and as the wonderful general and I have been speaking about. We know the first shot in World War One was fired by an African soldier. We know that, don't we? We also know that the last shot in World War One was fired on the African continent in Zambia. So the narrative and the story is we're inextricably linked to that.
Mm.
And it's a sad twist of fate that for some reason 2 million lives were not seen to be commemorated, as the wonderful poet Nairobi eloquently explained today on the square.
Well, we've got the wonderful poet Nairobi Thompson with us. She's an academic as well, a passionate performance poet. How did you... Would you mind just retracing that moment at Windrush Square? How did you eloquently describe those the missing 2 millions, the commemoration to the missing 2 million, if you like?
Well, I shared a poem that I wrote last year entitled They Had No Choice, and it was about a memorial in Park Lane, Hyde Park, that commemorates the lives of animals who served in the World Wars. Pigeons, elephants, donkeys, and you know, £2 million was raised to raise that monument, and it was raised 90th year before the centenary celebrations of World War One, and it was just incredible to me that £2 million was raised. You know, national appeals were made to raise that money. Philanthropists, right honourable persons, royalty contributed to commemorate the role that was played by animals, and yet we've had to work so hard to raise a fraction of that amount of money.
But there is that commemoration in Hyde Park, or Hyde Park Corner, you know, leading on to Buckingham Palace, of Commonwealth soldiers. That is there, though. That is a permanent...
Yes,
memorial,
but we're
though.
talking about making sure all of the contributions, not just notional contributions or acknowledgements. There were, you know, there were the stories that have not been told, you know, and in the media, in theatre, in plays, in music, there's just a deliberate whitewashing of our contributions. Everybody, it's human nature to be acknowledged and to be validated. So it's not about division or dividing. It's about recognition. And if people have given the ultimate sacrifice, then there shouldn't be just a clubbing together and an anonymizing of those contributions. We should be talking about those very specific stories and validating those contributions.
I can't wait to hear that poem. I can't wait. You brought somebody with you as well, as I see. We've got another military veteran in the studio with us as well. Sir, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Yeah, so who do I owe the honour and the pleasure of this programme to?
I'm indeed pleased to be here tonight.
Yes.
As a military, ex-military person, I served in World War II. I was the president of the Western Ex-Servicemen Association, which is now known as Western Association of Service Personnel, which has stood its time of life over 70 years ago. Our numbers are diminishing, but we made a contribution at the time of the nation needed people. When the nation was depleted of people, King George V called on the members of the empire and the Commonwealth to come and support him. And we from the West Indies responded. And in so doing, so many 15,000 people came from the West Indies. Not only did the West Indian countries made contributions and picked up their pennies and sold their pots and sold their ware to make a contribution to the war effort so that people in Africa and the rest of the world who were ruled by the British at that time when they had colonialism before there was independence of these states, which are now recognized parties to the world and global empire.
Wow, what a speech. Name, rank and service number, though, is what I should ask you.
The name is Neil Flanagan.
Think about that one.
Rank?
MBE.
MBE, of course.
I was honoured by Her Majesty the Queen in the year 2001 for services to the country because I was involved in rehousing, education, series of hot operations, which I gave my time as a payback to the nations for what they did to me. Because after World War II, they did offer me a scholarship, and I went to college in England. And in so doing, I'm grateful for that particular exercise. However, my service in the Royal Air Force has served me well because I was in avionics, as they call it today. And not only did I avionics, I did design and operated the bombs that fell on alien soil.
And what was your rank?
My rank was the humblest situation of leading aircraft man at the time.
That's fine. That's it. Doesn't sound like any humble rank to me at all. You enjoyed your time in the military.
It's not a case of enjoying. I lived really? Through the time.
Yeah, literally.
There's no enjoyment in war. Wars are horrible. War are terrible. People died around me. I saw them die, and I see the aircraft crash, and I've flown an aircraft. And at the Battle of Arnhem, I didn't go, but we sent off men who did not return, and a lot of people died because of the weather, mismanagement, and the enemy was waiting for the British troops. And also at Normandy, men died like flies, and in previous battles, people died. And the state of this nation was devastated by the Germans, so much so that after the war, there was nothing left of it. And there were some strange people who came from the Caribbean, who came and rebuilt the nation structure. And I think, by recognition, they were called the people from Windrush.
I think you could be right there.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We'll do the research, though. We'll check.
I think you'll be happy.
How did it affect you, though, Mr. Flanagan? How did it affect you to have colleagues that went and flew out in war, but who didn't return? How did that affect you?
The tragedies of war is horrific, as I said. You lose the sense and worry about mortality. There's no excuse if you are ordered to go forward. When you're in the military, you have no option. Fortunately or unfortunately, those who died for the nation had to go forward. When you are in the forces, regardless of whether it be British, American, or whatever forces, you have to do the job, which is you're told to do. Sometimes you may be fortunate to miss the bullet. Sometimes when we had the V1s and the V2 flying over London, one would never know whether they're going to be there the next minute. And Britain was in a state of desolation and destruction. So in a war, there is no option. Today's citizens do not recognize what happened in those days, and their parents and their forefathers and their grandfathers died. And they were not all white people, they were all the people of other color. And the people of other color who gave their lives throughout not only Britain, throughout the Far East from the West Indian regiments who traveled overseas, they gave their life to the nation, for England, Britain. We know we had the Portuguese, we had the Germans, we had other countries, but they were in the German Axis. And the Russians were then, at that time, parted to the British, joined friends of the British. And when the war became terrific, and they had no more, and they couldn't build ships, they called on Americans to build ships, and then they gave away the countries and land lease and a lot of different contracts to keep alive, so that we did not become Germans in Britain.
A lot to think about, and we'll be talking more about this in the second hour of the programme as well. I've introduced you to all my guests. Leading Airman Neil Flanagan there, West Indian Servicemen Association person, and somebody who took part in the Second World War as well. We've spoken to Stanley Roy Archer, more commonly known as Master Roy, who took part in the British Army as part of his national service in the early 50s. We've got Major Jared Flurry with us of the United States Army, Assistant Professor of English at West Point as well. English, that's why he's quoting all the great literary figures of American literature as well. Dr. Jack Pula is with us, Nubian Jack, who's responsible for getting the acknowledgement or putting the black into the British history, if you like, with blue plaques all over the place in London. He's been doing that for many years, but also organised a Remembrance Day event at Windrush Square in Brixton today. Nairobi Thompson was one of the guests at that. She's got a poem. Would you read the poem for us after the 9 o'clock news?
Yes, I'd love to.
I can't wait for that.